Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today, I have a special episode for you that I thought was lost. Sometimes when I record podcast episodes, audio files can get corrupted or go missing. This is one of those situations. But luckily, I was able to recover it. Today, I have for you Maggie Paul. Maggie is the author of Scrimshaw, Borrowed World, and the chapbook Stones from the Baskets of Others. Her poetry, reviews, and interviews have appeared in the Catamaran Literary Reader, Rattle, the Monterey Poetry Review, Porter Gulch Review, Red Wheelbarrow, Frenzy, Salt, and others. She is a poet and a nonfiction writer in Santa Cruz, California. Our focus in this conversation is twofold. First, we cover some of her famous conversation interviews with poets and writers from across California. We also discuss the history of California poetry. It was a wonderful conversation. I know you'll love it. Let's go meet Maggie Paul. Maggie, I was reading your interview with Al Young, and something that stuck out to me that I want to start with is a phrase that he said, which is places us, yes. Which I think is something that I want to really kind of focus on at the start of our conversation here, because when we classify poets by region, we're saying that there's something about the region that defines them. And so do you agree with what Al said about place being us, and what does that mean for what a poet produces?
Okay, so I have that quote right here, and he says, not only does place locate us, place is us. Everything we see around us that we think of as environment, that is us. And I do agree in the sense that it's not a conscious relationship, the reciprocal relationship we have with our environment and ourselves. I think it's something that's going on all the time that we're usually unconscious of. But I do think that the longer that you stay in the place, the more that you inhabit it, the place begins to inhabit you. And my experience with that is real in the sense that I'm from the East Coast. I grew up in Massachusetts and very provincial, very, you know, granite and cobblestone and history going back to 1620 with the houses literally right down my street. And with different, you know, poets and literary influences. And then I came out here in 92. I've been here, I can't believe it, 30 years, but now I feel very much ensconced in a California sensibility. And I'm more aware of it when I go back home because I realize I'm different. I'm not who I was when I left there.
Well, I feel like when I read poets that are placed, like I feel those places in me too. And like I feel it particularly when I read like Mary Oliver, for example, I feel the place in her. And I can almost, you know, just kind of feel what she feels in a way. Now, what's interesting, I think, about talking about California as a place. And we can talk about this other thing I read in your interviews about literary microclimates. Mm. Is California is a amalgamation of all these kind of very different places. Yeah. And so one of the things that we've talked about in the past and talking about what it makes a California poet is it is if the kind of concept is even useful. So is it useful given the diversity of California to think about poetry in that kind of California sense?
I would argue that it is. And at the same time, I would say that a powerful poem is going to be of its place, but it's also going to transcend its place. It's also going to transcend its time. If someone says that your poetry is regional, it's not exactly a compliment because it means that, yes, it's from a particular time and place, but 20 years from now, you know, the reader may not be able to envision or relate to that.
I mean, it's kind of like the way in history circles we talk about like municipal history or something, where it's just, it's kind of this something that is used as a derogatory way of saying that it's kind of
provincial or just kind of insular, and it's more about just people that live there. And so I guess the kind of the question I have really then is there, what is the through line for California poetry for you? What is there something there that underlies, you know, most California poets? Is there kind of a shared sensibility? Is it a backdrop? What is it for you that California poets have in common?
That is a very good question, because I hesitate to say that there is such a thing. I like different poets for different reasons. I will say that, and Joe Stroud mentions this in his interview in Catamaran, that the Pacific Northwest, including the state of California, at least the northern part of the state, is influenced highly by the Asian, the Pacific Rim sensibility or tenor. In other words, you know, we look to Japan, we look to China, we look to Vietnam, we look to across the Pacific, and what has filtered from across the Pacific into California, it's almost like drinking the Kool-Aid in a beautiful way, is these ancient Chinese and Japanese poets whose work infiltrates into poetry that's being written right now in California and has been probably for the past 50 years.
And that's interesting, so that because a lot of that came from translation, correct?
Yes.
And so can you talk about that connection between translation and how that created kind of a milieu in California?
Well, it's a combination of translation, and also some poets have made a point of living in Japan and living in China. Even most recently, David Sullivan, who's our current poet laureate in Santa Cruz, spent a year in China and has been writing out of that experience with translators. But yeah, translation, it's a beautiful thing, because of course it makes you look at your own language differently and use your own language differently. And with the, say, Basho and Issa and Li Po and Du Fu, you know, it's this idea of non-attachment, and yet at the same time, very specific, complete attention to nature. And I do think that kind of runs through much of California poetry, in my experience, at least in the generations, you know, maybe currently, I'm not so sure how big of an influence it is right now, but certainly in the people I've studied in the past few generations, that's been a distinguishing factor of California poetry.
So that's kind of, if we were talking about microclimates, that's one of the climates. Then you also have, where I am is in the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. How would you classify that or talk about that as a region and think about poetry in the agricultural part of California?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because I just had the opportunity to read and review this book, Naming the Lost, the Fresno Poets, that Chris Buckley just put out. And it's so delightful, because there's a lot of irreverence and character and experiences and relationships and friendships of poetry that has come out of Fresno that is its own thing. It is its own microclimate. And, you know, Phil Levine was really the beginning of that, and people that went to Fresno State to study with him and work with him. So yeah, I think that is more of a working class, you know, farm worker, agriculture, Mexican influenced. That is another California, and it is its own beautiful, complicated thing, which I believe the Fresno poets, lucky for us, managed to dig into literally and figuratively to bring forward. Because it's not the San Francisco Bay, California. It's not the LA, California. It is its own thing. And it is really, I think, as someone from the East Coast, I'm so grateful. It really enriches everyone's lives to know about the agricultural backbone of this state, where Absolutely. Our food comes from.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I don't often plug podcasts of friends, but Alice Daniel, who's at our KVPR affiliate in Fresno is producing a podcast called The Other California.
Wonderful.
That highlights small towns and communities in the Central Valley to give people that are living in kind of the bigger, more densely populated areas of California a picture of this place that is deeply tied to is part of the tapestry of California, but is kind of on the backside of the tapestry, something that you drive through or fly over. So, and then there's this other huge pocket of California, which is Southern California, which has a completely different vibe and, I guess, outlook. You know, we've got Hollywood, we've got a lot of things that have influenced that. And so, and we don't talk about that as much, at least when in the previous conversations I've had about California poetry. What sticks out for you in Southern California if you're looking at that as a microclimate?
Well, you know, I'm not very well versed with Southern California in general. I haven't spent a lot of time there. I do know that there are a lot of terrific writers there. I can't imagine competing with or being in the milieu of the Hollywood, you know, atmosphere and not being saturated by that. So hats off to poets in Los Angeles and Southern California. I mean, I know that unless you live there, my son lives there and he has a wonderful life. And I think he knows it, of course, from the inside out, as I do not. So I think that people that live there have their pockets of neighborhoods and their pockets of, you know, artist communities. But I personally am not familiar, so I can't really offer too much on that. I do think about Chris Buckley, and of course I've read so much of his work, and much of it, you know, does involve like sort of almost the Beach Boy sort of view, but, you know, looking toward the ocean, being very oriented toward the beach and the water. And fortunately, you know, he elevates it in infinite ways with his poetry. And of course, Dana Gioia has written about Southern California. But I'm sorry to say, I really am not familiar enough to comment on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a complicated environment for art because of the intense capitalist churning of art down there and all the people competing for attention and, you know, the loudness of it. I imagine it's different than, you know, what we were just talking about. I'm going to go picturing someone in Santa Cruz walking through the woods versus someone stuck on the 405, you know, you're just going to produce different kinds of art. I want to talk a little bit about how place has influenced your poetry. Mm-hmm. And if you could share kind of how you feel, because you mentioned that being here for 30 years now, you feel like a Californian. And is Santa Cruz how you kind of, when you think about who you are and your environment, do you think of yourself as a Santa Cruz poet?
Oh, I'm afraid to answer this question.
And what is a Santa Cruz poet?
I suppose at this point, I surrender. I've always been a poet, I've always been a poet oriented toward nature. You know, I grew up with Thoreau and Robert Frost, who I know is from San Francisco, but, you know, lived most of his life in New England. Emerson, Dickinson, that's where I come from. And I know I became a poet, you know, living in Maine every summer in the woods for months on end. I know I became a poet there. So to me, actually, my poetic leanings or sensibility is just been the same orientation to nature has just been transferred or transitioned to Californians. Now, I don't have the pine trees here, but I have the redwoods. I have, you know, I don't have the birch trees. I have, you know, the eucalyptus or the sycamore or whatever. So I'm still sort of in the same place that I was when I started out. The difference, I think, is that when I lived back east and I was really more of an urban creature, I lived in New York for 15 years. I worked in Manhattan in all sorts of industries. And I lived an urban life to a large degree. now the blessing is I walk out the door and, you know, the ocean's 5 minutes away, you know, I can take hikes, you know, just walking. So nature is closer physically to me, which feels like a gift, like that a poet would, how lucky could I be? And so, you know, but I don't think my poetry has changed that much. The images have changed because, you know, what I'm looking at is different. But I think the orientation to it, the reciprocity between nature and myself has always been there, and it continues.
So you see it as a relationship between you and your environment. It's a give and take back and forth in some ways.
Yes, I really do. Yeah.
So let's transition and talk a little bit about these wonderful interviews you did with Catamaran. Mm-hmm. And I want to start first just because I'm, you know, I interview people myself. How do you prepare for an interview with a poet?
I do a lot of reading. I do a lot of reading and research and note-taking. And then I try not to read other interviews that they've done very much. A little bit, but not until I've done all of my own reading and taken my own notes and developed my own ideas. But, you know, my interviews are, I do them via email so that the author, the poets have plenty of time to respond. I want them to be, you know, I want them to have depth. I want them to reach into places that other interviews they've given have not. So I usually start a few months in advance and I spend a few months with that poet privately, unbeknownst to them. And then I send them my questions, and then I always send more than I tell them. I'm sure this is more than you're ever going to want to respond to. So please choose what interests you the most. And send back to me. And I feel very fortunate through email. But it's thing, and we're writers, and so I feel like it's even better in a way because we both get to take the time to be thoughtful and deliberate about it.
Yeah, it's, I think, one of the favorite interviews with authors that I enjoy just reading on a weekly basis is New York Times does this thing called By the Book, where they interview authors and actors and politicians about the things that they read. And I think it's in a similar model where they're just given these set lists of questions, and it's different than what we're doing. You know, there's less kind of creative opportunities for enterprise, but or improvisation, but there is a time to really think and answer well. Now, I guess the question is when you're thinking, how do you come up with the questions you're going to ask? Is it informed by your reading and preparation?
I think it is, and I think it's also just informed perhaps by my own curiosity about language, about the effect of language on others, I'm just fascinated by the art. You know, I'm fascinated by the silences and the spaces in poetry, and I'm fascinated by all of the tools, so to speak, that we have at our disposal. I'm as fascinated by what isn't said as what is, because I always think that those spaces are loaded. So I might ask about those spaces. But I've always been someone who loves to analyze poetry and write about writing. And so I don't know, I just have a good time with that.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you just a few questions about some of the people you interviewed and what you took away.
Okay.
I want to start with Al Young, who I love. And mm-hmm. I talked about in a previous interview, loving this book, the name's escaping me right now. It's a collection that came with a CD where you could listen to him reading the poems, which is wonderful because I feel like you just need to hear his voice. But my question about Al is, what did you learn from him about poetry's relationship to music?
Yes, he doesn't. I really don't think he separates the two. Okay. I think that he, as many musicians do, I think that the music is in their body. And I think that, you know, his voice is an instrument. It's interesting and lovely because, you know, several people, I just learned, I was reading today, Kenneth Rexroth also used to play to music. And I know Robert Bly played to music. And but I think that that was an essential for Al, an essential part of his upbringing, coming from Mississippi and then being in Detroit and surrounded by music. And he was one of those people, kind of, you know, a Renaissance man in the sense that I don't think there was anything he didn't enjoy, from what I can tell, in terms of his joie de vivre. He really was open and a creative being, and he wanted to participate, it seemed, in a lot of different expressions of art, you know?
Yeah, and I talked about this with Dana a little bit in our conversation, but just the kind of, I want to say, a lot of poetry is disconnected from voice. And thinking about music, it's an auditory experience. And, you know, I guess what I'm kind of reaching for right now is just this, you know, this place of does poetry need to try to return to this place of voice and delivery? And I know that there's slam poetry, and that is something where it's delivery is a key part, but there is a lot of poetry these days that is very, it feels disconnected from vocal presentation. And I don't know if that's a bad thing. I don't, because poetry is just what we make it. It's just for us, you know, right? It's just for us, for our experience. But I guess that's kind of partly what I was wanted to talk about with Al, is just, you know, does the presentation, how the poetry is delivered, matter?
It's interesting that you bring this up, because in one of these books on Jack Foley, and I think it is someone who's commenting actually on Dana Joya's return to formalism.
Yeah.
So rhyme and meter and such. There was an excellent comment about how when we went into free verse, and when rhyme and meter and the musicality of the language was put on the back burner or to the side, that's when poetry lost its audience, because the mnemonics of the musicality of the language are what help people, you know, just like with songs, you can't get that lyric out of your head because it rhymes and it has rhythm and it's repeated, right? And we do not, you know, unless you're doing some sort of formalism, you don't have that incorporated in your free verse. It is possible to have it in free verse, but you have to be really acutely aware of sound and rhythm. And fortunately, really good poets are, but there's a lot of poets that are not. And I do think it is unfortunate, because that separation that you mention is the type of thing where the audience can experience something, but then as soon as it's over, whatever that was is gone. And I'm going to be thinking about that now myself a little bit more, because of course, if you're taking your life to time in your life to write, one of the most important things about it is that you want it to be memorable.
Yeah.
And if it's not memorable because it's lacking some of those really primitive needs that the human, you know, being has out of experience, then what are we doing?
Yeah. And I know things change, you know, and I know that poetry is evolving like everything else. And I just am reading the book of poetry that won the National Book Award last year, DMZ Colony. It's about the demilitarized zone and some areas alongside of it in Korea. And it is memorable in different ways, visually and how it's organized. And it feels as much poetry as kind of like a visual art as well. And so, you know, it feels like, kind of like in a sense of like, when I think about like evolution and how there's all these like veins that go different directions, you know, it feels like this is another direction poetry's taken. I just hope it's not the only vein, if that makes sense, you know. And right. I think there are veins, there are performative veins like in hip hop and different and slam poetry. And so maybe it's just a world where we just need lots of people doing lots of things, you know, to keep a lot of these important traditions alive.
Right.
Well, let's talk about another poet you interviewed, Joseph Stroud. What did you learn about finding poetry in the mundane from him?
I don't recall that. Did he say that in the
interview? No, that's my kind of take of reading him.
It's interesting because my first reaction is that I don't know that he would use the word mundane. He is one of those poets who I think is influenced by the East and has learned to look at things very particularly, you know, given things great attention and refusing, as do those ancient poets, to complicate the language, which I personally love that. I love the translucent clarity and particularity of the observations that a poet like Joe Stroud makes. Because then, of course, as Mary Oliver would say as well, I mean, nothing should be overlooked from the tiniest, you know, grain of sand, so to speak, you know. But, and I know that his practice of attention, he's a very disciplined poet. He's a very disciplined poet. I just wrote a poem about him called The Calling, in which I invited him to, and this was fictitious, but not really so fictitious, inviting him to read and the poet saying, and realizing that I was actually asking the poet to leave the space that he has spent his whole life, developing within himself so that he can write. I'm asking him to leave that and do a social thing. And in the poem, I end up apologizing to him for asking him to leave such a place. And then the next morning I wake up and I'm looking for that place too. But yeah, he's a very disciplined poet. And I think his work, the clarity and the sort of the illumination of the moment.
Yeah. He sees with certain eyes, and that's how I felt when I've read him. I want to talk about Gary Soto for a minute. Mm-hmm. Of the interviews of yours that I read, he seemed the most cagey, maybe is the right word. I'm not sure. And he's an interesting character. And I think I don't know if this is your perception of him, but some poets, and maybe that's kind of, you know, there's this, my background is in religion, and there's kind of this in kind of more Eastern Orthodox religion, Christianity, there's kind of this idea of negative theology where you're not trying to be tied down to something and you're more saying what you're not than what you are.
Interesting.
And so I guess what did you learn from Gary about poetry in that kind of short interview that you did with him?
Yeah. Well, I think that was a good description. He's done so many things. I think he's published like 40 books or something crazy like that. And most recently, or at least within the past few years, he wrote a musical. So no, I don't think he wants to be pinned down. And his claim to fame is largely through his young adult fiction and his children's books. A lot of us have taught his work at the community colleges for years and years, and they've just been fantastic because he has this wonderful ability to be, well, just to be honest. And I think to go back to being 14 or to go back to being 15, you know, the humor, the tragedy and the comedy of being a teenager and a Mexican-American teenager and someone whose parents were, you know, working in agriculture in Fresno, and then he himself worked in agriculture in Fresno and also in the factories in Fresno. So he's very, I think his natural voice is very endearing and direct. And I think one of the things I said at the end of the interview, which is true, it's not as if he's writing for his readers, but he's talking to them directly. He's like in a conversation with them immediately. Hey, this is what happened yesterday. It's Joe Smith's house down at the pub and or whatever, you know.
Yeah, that's, I've read a few of his, or I guess two. I don't know. He's done a lot, so it's hard to keep track of what I've read. But yeah, it does feel kind of quick, and it feels like with a sense of urgency. Mm. And that could be because of you know, the difficulties of life where he comes from, and just the challenges and how quickly, you know, bad things can happen, you know. And I kind of think about that as I drive to work, because I drive through farm fields to get to the school where I teach, and
yes,
you know, seeing the animals on the side of the road, you know, just how quickly life and death are right on the edge. And I know that's true in other places, but it's very acute when you're kind of near all this agriculture. And yeah, it's something that maybe I think about, and maybe he thinks about.
I think that actually that serves him well, because if we remember, I mean, when you are young, everything does feel urgent. I mean, in addition to the cultural, you know, the situation, the environment that he's in. But I think that serves his writing well, and it makes it immediate. It makes it feel like it's happening right now.
Yeah. I want to talk about women poets in California. And I honestly have done my listeners a disservice. I feel like I've highlighted male poets in a significant way. And we've talked about Adrienne Rich in the past before, but beyond that, we really haven't dipped into women poets in California. And, you know, I was recently talking with someone about the fact that the first poet laureate of California was a woman, Ina Coolbrith, a librarian and an amazing poet from early in California history, but is little known. Who are some of your favorite women poets from California? And if you could just share some of your favorites for us, that would be wonderful.
Okay. Well, I would have to say some of these poets, they're spending more and more time in California, but they are transplants or they're transitioning. And so the first person that comes to mind really for me is Dorian Lox. She's been teaching in North Carolina and living with Joe Millar, her husband, in North Carolina, who's also a terrific poet, for a long time, but they are transitioning out here, and they're more and more involved in Santa Cruz in particular, which was so lucky. But her work has always shaken me in the right way. And apparently her first book was chosen by Phil Levine for a national award of some sort. So she's still writing vociferously and really well. And there's a woman, well, there's Kim Adnesio, who is out of San Francisco, that you're probably familiar with. And there's a few people that this magazine, Catamaran Literary Readers, has become a wonderful vessel of poetry in the area and also nationally, but it does have a sort of a, you know, Northern California bent to it. And they have a contest every year now for a new book to come out. And a few of the people whom they've published are quite good. And so Susan Brown is one of them, and her book is called Just Living. And I'm starting to see her work in a lot of different places. Very, very strong. Another woman who's actually from the East Bay, well, she's from Massachusetts, I learned recently, but she lives in the East Bay and has for many years. And her name is Allison Luderman. And her recent book is called In the Time of Great Fires. And then another woman through Catamaran, whose book came through there, is Michelle Biting. And her recent book is called Broken Kingdom. And all of their work is quite good. And then I would say Danusha Lamaris, who was a former poet laureate prior to David Sullivan. And The Moons of August is her first book. And her second book is out from Pitt Poetry Press. And oh gosh, it has a really terrific, irreverent title that I'm blanking on right now. I'm sorry, Danusha. But she's doing really well, and she's very active, and her work is very powerful in so many ways. So there are a lot of women right now, you know, who are, Dionne O'Reilly is another one. She's local. And some of these people are like Dionne and Danusha and Farnaz, who's an Iranian poet, whose first book is just coming out. They are involved in a poetry show on a KSQD, which is a public radio station, on Sunday nights. and it's quite good. And they interview poets almost every Sunday, and a lot of new work comes through them, that show.
Well, let's close by talking about book recommendations. I love book recommendations. So these can be recent, either in terms of what you've read recently or just important books for you in thinking about California poetry. So we can think broadly if we want to, just about things that have mattered to you over the years or things that are recently important to you.
Okay, well, thank you. So I thought you might ask this question, so I made a little list. And I have several anthologies, because obviously you get exposed to more and more poets that way, and then you can go and find their particular collections. So, of course, some of these you're familiar with. You've interviewed people. The Geography of Home, which is by Gary Young and Chris Buckley. Bear Flag Republic is another one. Naming the Lost, which I mentioned, for the Fresno poets. Now, I love Czesław Miłosz's A Book of Luminous Things. And it's just worldwide. It's absolutely wonderful collection. And I can't say enough about it. I often refer to Robert Bly's The Winged Energy of Delight, which is a book of selected translations. Also, you know, a global view, really. This is an anthology also by Kevin Young, the editor of The New Yorker and poetry, and a wonderful poet himself. And it's called The Art of Losing, which is poems about grief and such, but so much more. And then I'm starting to enjoy some anthologies that James Cruz is putting together, one of which is called Healing the Divide, Poems of Kindness. But I think he's sort of on a trajectory of doing a few of those, pulling together some really beautiful contemporary poems of gentle nature to sort of combat the difficulties of what's going on right now. I had some, well, books of essays, Jane Hirschfield's Nine Gates, of course, and her other book of essays called 10 Windows. Memoirs, I was going to mention, if Dana didn't, his book on studying with Miss Bishop.
That one's on my list. I have that one on the list. I've been meaning to get after that one, because I do like, I love anything that's pedantic and there's someone teaching someone else. Maybe it's just because I'm a teacher. I just gravitate to that, you know, but yeah, that's been on the list.
It's enjoyable. And you know, it's personal. I mean, here's the thing, the Fresno Poets book too. There are so many personal anecdotes in there. There are so many things that you would never know, that only because their friends put them in do we get a little peek into their, you know. So there are a lot of little delights in there. For new and selected, I would say, you know, Joe Stroud's Of This World, which is just terrific. And I haven't mentioned him, but Robert Sword, who we recently lost, sadly, in February, has a new and selected called All That I Have Not Made. And Robert Sword is a curious, was prolific, a lot of humor and a lot of pathos in his poems. And I think what he's most famous for is writing through the voice of other people. Just a dialogue, just incredibly. And so he has this book called Rosicrucian in the Basement. His father in real life was a podiatrist, a Jewish podiatrist, and he used to always give Robert a hard time about being a poet. And the way that he would do it was he would make all these metaphors about the importance of your feet and being grounded and the fact that you're a poet and you're, you know, you're not grounded. Yeah. Anyway, very, very good stuff in there. And Nebraska poems, this is just a collection, not just, but it's a great collection by Kwame Dawes. In terms of poems of place, you know, he's from Ghana. He grew up in Jamaica. He now lives in Nebraska. And what a change of environment. And he writes really beautifully about how that is at work in him, those changes, and how he's actually identifying at different times with this new crazy snowy place, even though he's from the tropics, you know, from tropical Jamaica. And then a Wendell Berry, anything by him is just lovely. So,
well, let's close by talking about what you're working on. So what are you spending your time on these days?
Well, I am working on two things. I continue to write poems. I've been doing a little bit of what they call eco poetry. I'm about to do something, a few poems that are actually trying to delve into the multiple selves that one carries within them. So through the voices of different aspects of the self, series of poems there. And then I'm also working on attempting to pull together some memoir pieces. And what I've always had this in mind, the landscape of the East Coast and the landscape of the West Coast. And now having lived in both of those places for large chunks of my life, how that external landscape reflects one's inner landscape. And also just this, I have, you know, I'm from an Irish Catholic family in Boston and during the 1960s and all of the, you know, very large family and all of us did very different things. So there's a lot of material and I'm just trying to not rein it in. I guess don't want to do that, but I'm playing with it and I want to do something really fun with all that stuff.
Well, that sounds great. I can't wait to see what to read it and to follow your work. I really appreciate you having this conversation with me.
Thank you, Jordan. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.